Pues. Already on. All right, I am. Hot mic. I'm actually going to go ahead and start as people continue to trickle out because I keep talking about catching up, and week by week I seem to be falling further behind. So one of these Wednesdays I'm going to fix that and remedy that. We began a discussion last week on using the art of telling a story to influence people. We talked about this entire premise behind our book is to look at the different ways in which Jesus influenced people, and he did so in many ways, and he did so perfectly time after time again. But there were some things that we could draw from Jesus's interactions with people and maybe apply them in our own lives and apply them when we have an opportunity to do so. And the one we focused on last week was on telling a story. Now, I know we've got some visitors who might be joining us for the first time, and so you are exempt from this particular portion of Bible class. But what was something that we talked about last week? We talked about Jesus' stories being maybe very special because Jesus' stories did what? It related to them. Okay, so Jesus had a way of telling a story that affected someone because it had something to do with their life. Okay, and we talked about also specifically that each of us are probably affected by different kinds of stories. I shared a couple of the kinds of stories that I am affected by, and we talked about that the stories that affect us cause us to what? Experience and have emotions, all right? When a story is told in the right way, sometimes, and this might be frustrating to think about, sometimes it might be more influencing on someone than the scriptures themselves. And so we might use it as an avenue to the scriptures. But we talked about how stories elicit response and emotion. And we talked about specifically last week about one story that Jesus told in particular. Which story was it that did we really study of Jesus's? The Good Samaritan. What did we say was so unique about the Good Samaritan that is kind of lost when we think of it in 21st century terms? So there was something about it. Yeah, who the man was. The man was a Samaritan. And in Jesus' term, for the protagonist or the good guy in a story to be a Samaritan would have been scandalous. And so when we talked about last week, we reread that with some kind of a 21st century twist on it. And it kind of took made us think about that story in a different light. And we said, that's what a good story does. That's the power of a great story. It provokes as it proffers. It prods as it progresses. It shakes people from their comfort zones and gets them asking questions they have never considered asking. And so the last little section of this particular lesson is going to just really be some suggestions and ideas that we can use as we tell stories. Now, that might sound a little bogus, but believe it or not, if you're going to be effective at using a story to influence someone, then you got to be what? You got to be a good storyteller. Grandpa, how many nights do you think I asked you to tell me the story of the three little bears or the three little pigs? Do you remember in the house at Jeff? Over and over again. Grandpa, tell me a story. And I used to try to tell the stories to other people, and I couldn't do it the way he did it. There was just something special about the way he did it. Do you have anybody like that in your life? That when you're around him, you go, hey man, tell that story. You know that one story about that thing? Chris has got about 20 of them. If I ever am just down in the dumps, I just call and say, hey Chris, tell me a story about something that happened to him one time. He's had a lot of fun stuff happen to him. And people say the same thing about me. Big Red, tell us about that time when you were a Christian counselor for Faulkner, and you met that one kid. And I get to tell that story about that funny kid. But that's kind of the premise here, is that, you know, we want to get better at telling these stories. And each time we tell it, hopefully, it becomes a unique experience that might actually affect somebody. It's worth the effort for us to use this approach more often, especially if we know that when people really listen, it can stimulate change. So if somebody's really going to listen to a story that we're telling, then we really need to make sure that we're telling it in a way that can affect them. They listen to stories because they are non-threatening and disarming. I can't tell you the number of times I've used it in a class where I've got two kids that are fighting, and I tell a story about, well, you know, I want to tell you about these two other boys that I had that fought and how they resolved their story. It disarms a situation. It can take a very hostile situation, and then bam, we're face to face with an uncomfortable truth. That story was really about me. We may try to run, but that story shadows us wherever we go. And I've often told Patty this. Somebody will tell a story, and two or three days later I'll go, I can't get that story out of my head. That one affected me somehow. And so that's what we want a good story to do, especially if that story is about God, or that story is about some part of their life that they need to fix, or if that story is about a Christian who overcame incredible odds to do something. We want someone else to do that. And so when we do that, we need to make sure we're telling that story in a way that's going to lead to success. So make a habit of telling stories and efforts to persuade. Invest time in discovering stories that may serve as a wake-up call for some. You might have somebody who's struggling with something that you don't have any clue how to deal with. Well, I don't even know how I deal with that. There's a story out there about it, y'all. If there's a story, if you've got a friend and they're just struggling with X, if you go out there and look for a story, and you might have to adapt your story. There's probably a story in the Bible that you could use. You might have to just dig, but find a story that relates to that person, and it might serve as a wake-up call. Take time to become a better storyteller by developing a delivery that's enjoyable and enlightening. I will be the first to admit, I have practiced telling a story before. I really have. Like if I was going to use it in a sermon, I have literally practiced, well, what parts do I want to leave in? Well, I can leave that part out. It doesn't really affect the story, so I don't waste the audience's time. I practice using stories when I teach to my students. There are different ways that we can do that. Our kids do this if they use stories when they tell when they use their Lads to Leader speeches. Several of our kids use stories and examples. I'm looking at Sarah back there about the story. I can remember the story of the great Blondini, who was the guy who was the tightrope walker. And I remember that story because it was in one of her children's Lads to Leader speeches. That's the last time I heard that story, but that story has stuck with me because of the way it was presented. You want to present the story in a way that's enjoyable and enlightening. This concept works in nurseries and in nursing homes and everywhere in between. So like Jesus, if you want to master the art of influence, master the art of storytelling. So we're getting to those kind of those practical things. Many times in the Bible where a story is used effectively in the Bible. Tell me some examples where a story was used effectively. Where somebody in the Bible used the story to absolutely convey exactly what they were thinking. Yes, ma'am. And I don't think there's a more perfect example. David had just stolen someone's wife. Murdered Uriah. And Nathan needs David to understand what a heinous thing he's done. And Nathan would have had every right to kick his door down and say, you wife-stealing murderer. But Nathan knew that probably wasn't going to work. So instead he goes and he tells a story about a man who had a little lamb. And he loved this lamb so much that he really treated it more like a pet or like a part of his family. And someone came, and someone who was rich and had much more possessions than this one man, and came and took his lamb and used it either in a feast or a sacrifice or for a meal of some kind. And David was outraged. And Nathan got to tell him, that story is about you, David. That's what you've done. How profound that story became. Nathan used a simple story to accomplish an incredible objective. Any other stories Jesus, of course, told story after story. Grandpa, what's one you're thinking of? Samson. Yeah, he sure was. Absolutely, yeah. I never thought about him. Samson. All right, any others? Yeah. And I think what you'll find, absolutely, and I think what you'll find, I put Nathan and David, Paul telling about his conversion. Think about that. You think Paul, I think I have it up here maybe. No. Do you think Paul ever practiced that? Like, think about it. You think when he went to visit a church that he'd never been to, you know, and they get there and they're talking casually, he said, you know, when I was converted, and somebody goes, oh, we haven't heard that story. And Paul gets to kind of throw his shoulders back and say, let me tell you about it. I was on the road to Damascus one day. You think he ever practiced that and became better at telling that story? I would imagine so. You can make the argument that the Bible is one long, ongoing, complex, flowing story, but it all works together. Mastering the art of storytelling requires effort and time. I mentioned this. How many times do you think Paul told the story about what happened to him? Do you think he practiced telling it? There's lots to consider here and some tips that can help us with honing our craft. Choosing a story can be the hardest part, and we've kind of already talked about this a little bit. Analyze the situation and come up with a story. The more important the story is to the situation, the more valuable and believable your point's going to be. Keep it simple. A lot of the stories Jesus told had one protagonist. They weren't complex stories. They were very simple stories. Nathan's story to David, very simple. All right. Listeners can connect and empathize with one character very easily. Practice. Rehearse what you want to say. Even professionals practice. There are people out there, you could think of comedians, you could think of storytellers. They practice what they do because when they deliver what they're saying, they want it to be perfect. Relive the story when you tell it. I'll give you an example. One of the stories that I tell a lot because I get asked it a lot is the story about what happened when Anna was born. And that was a crazy time. And I've actually told it so many times right now that I can tell it less emotionally. But when I do tell it, I still get chill bumps. I still try to think about what it was like when the doctors told me crazy things about Anna and this and that. I relive it and memorize it because I'm trying to convey how I felt at that moment to the listener. I want them to connect with what happened. I want to remember how I felt. I want to consider the character. I can remember seeing different people at the hospital, and I'm remembering different parts of it, and hopefully my audience is going to do the same thing. This is a big one, I think, especially for using these stories to convert people or to get people to be interested more in God or Jesus, is use emotion. Be enthusiastic. I can't stand to sit through a story that's just drab and boring. I mean, never have inflection in your voice. You never get excited and scared. Be demonstrative. You guys know that about me. If I tell a story, there's usually some kind of motion with what I'm telling. I know Chris and I tell stories. He could get up here and tell the story about he got flustered once at a football game and might have tried to punt the ball. And when he punted it, he went just like, and when he tells that story, he demonstrates what he did. And it makes it that much more of a good story. Because we're demonstrative. People remember things when we're demonstrative. Use inflection. Speed up. Slow down at the right times. Enjoy telling stories. Have fun. And don't worry about what others think. That's something that I think prevents people from sharing stories sometimes. Is we're worried about what others think. Emma kind of struggles a little bit with being in front of people. And she's getting better. I was shocked to see her calling out names at the costume contest on Saturday. I was like, you know, she was nervous and embarrassed to pray in front of her softball team when the girls led the prayer, but then she can call out the, you know, names for that in front of, anyway. But, you know, she's worried in that situation about what others think. Don't worry about what others think. Talked about avoiding tangents and unnecessary details that detract from the story or the point being made. You know, you get right to the good part of the story and then, boom, somebody shoots off on a tangent and then you lose completely everything that you're doing. Does somebody have a hand up? Nope. Tell it often, even to the same audience. Why? So that they'll remember it. How many of you remember last week when the author told the story about, I think it's Genghis Khan and the hawk? You guys, give me one of these if you remember that story last week about Genghis Khan and the hawk. The author said that he went back about a year later and he asked his son, do you remember that story about Genghis Khan? And he said, the little boy said, yeah, Genghis Khan had a bear and they were looking for some water and then they all lived happily ever after. Well, why did that story eventually lose its effectiveness? Because it had been so long since he told it. He needed to go back and tell that story once or twice more to get the effectiveness of it to stick. All right? People forget lessons. Storytelling is contagious. This was an interesting thing that the author mentioned, and I thought it was very intelligent. Storytelling is contagious. When people hear a good story, they want to tell a good story. If you've got someone that you're trying to influence through a story, and then they want to do the same back, this can help immensely in an influence situation. At that moment, you really, you know, need to just stop what you're doing and let them talk to you. Because many times, through their own stories, they'll convict themselves. Be the audience that you want to have at that moment. We talked about people are convinced best when they convince themselves. I really can't state this any more than I've already mentioned it a few times. Don't be scared to make fun of yourself. I try to explain, you know, especially in youth ministry, this is really effective in youth ministry when you're trying to get kids to understand you did something foolish without thinking about it. I tell the story about how I climbed a dead tree once. I didn't know the tree was dead, and then I fell out of the tree. All right. If I had simply slowed down and thought, maybe I wouldn't have climbed a dead tree. I don't care that the kids giggle and laugh at me and think, man, you climbed a dead tree, what a doofus. It gets the point across. So sometimes some self-deprecating humor can relax and lighten a tense situation. In my job, kids fall all the time. Every day as a teacher, kids fall. And a second grader comes up to you, you know, he's walking like this. What happened? I broke my leg. And my first, oh, did you now? Tell me all about it. And then I usually they're not hurt, they're embarrassed, and they need attention, embarrassed. And I tell a story. Let me tell you about the time I fell down a flight of steps in Nashville, Tennessee, and that's a true story. I fell down a flight of steps, and they're like, and you fell down in front of all those people? And I was like, yeah, and you know what? I wasn't worried about it. I think you're okay, too. Do you think you're okay? Yeah, I think I'm okay. And they're right back in there in 10 or 15 seconds. With a simple story, you neutralize the situation. Keeps people's attention, and it lends credibility to what you're trying to say as well. This is the last little bit here. Have a story ready for any situation. A story for telling someone about God. A story for a new employee. A story for an embarrassing moment. And that's another thing that I practice. You know, if I meet somebody, you know, and they ask me about CrossFit. I have the CrossFit story ready. If I meet somebody and they ask me, oh, how'd you and Patty meet? I have the story about how Patty and I met. You know, oh, you know, when did you come to work at Flint? Oh, well, let me tell you about that. And I have a story ready for that. I have stories ready for every situation in hopes that it'll influence somebody in some way. There's no right or wrong way to do it. Find a style that suits you and go with it. If what we've talked about tonight doesn't work in your storytelling and your influence, scrap it. Come up with something that does work for you. And forge your own path. What's important is that you're using stories to tell the messages that God wants you to tell. All right. I've left myself 20 minutes. This might work. Nope. All right. So we kind of closed the book on lesson 7. We've only got 4 more meetings together after tonight, unless whoever's next is going to let me steal some Wednesdays in December. What we're talking about now is reframing the situation. Reframing a situation through a story, and now reframing a situation by constructing a contrast. Again, you can see kind of how we're at this middle point here. Next week, maybe part of this week, we'll finish a contrast, but we'll move on to metaphors. But this week, we're working on constructing a contrast. Have you ever been in a situation where you needed to say exactly the right thing? You ever had a boss ask you a question, maybe a friend, and they asked you a question and you knew you needed to be very delicate with your answer. I found myself in that situation quite often. A lot of times, I don't feel like I said the right thing. Rarely do I feel like, man, I said the right thing there. I usually feel the exact opposite. I usually feel, well, I botched that one pretty bad. But if we say something too harsh, we might run them off. If we say something vague, we might undervalue the significance of what we're talking about. If we say nothing, we might let an opportunity slip by. As ministers of the gospel, and if you're a Christian, you're a minister of the gospel, we might find ourselves in just such a precarious situation. Somebody might ask you a hard question. Somebody might ask you a really tough question. And you might need to answer it in a very precise way. Sometimes constructing a contrast can be exactly the right answer to those tough questions. And we're going to see here that Jesus did this perfectly. Can you think of a time when Jesus did this? The example that we're going to use tonight, is involving a very famous story that I had never considered that this was what Jesus did. I love this story very much, but I had never considered it with this particular literary device of constructing a contrast. One of my favorite stories in the New Testament about Jesus, but I'd never considered it in this light. Let's kind of frame the situation. Jesus basically gets set up. Okay, now if you'll notice, this is a theme through the New Testament. Jesus is always getting set up, which I think is humorous, because how are you going to set up a perfect person? He's got the right answer for everything. But Jesus was tried to set him up many times. Remember the lawyer, the religious guy, tried to set him up by asking him who his neighbor was and different things like that. So here's the setup. A mob had just brought a woman who was caught in the act of adultery. Okay? You guys know what story I'm already going. We're in John chapter 8, I believe. Why do I have the word brought in quotation marks? Yeah. Do you think so? When Jesus was carrying his cross, the soldiers compelled Simon of Cyrene to carry his cross? You think it was just, hey man, will you come carry Jesus' cross? It's not what I think it was. So when they brought this woman who was caught in the act of adultery, do you think they caught her in the act of adultery and they were like, oh hey, if you've got a second, could you come on over here with us? We'd like to take you somewhere. Do you think that's how it went? That's not how I think it went. I think they probably drug her. I think she was probably lucky to get something wrapped around her as she's getting drugged and basically thrown at Jesus' feet. All right? So this woman gets caught in the act of adultery. And this mob is touting the law of Moses. They didn't want to learn. They didn't want justice. They wanted blood. They wanted something to be done to this woman. They probably didn't really even care about what Jesus said until he says the perfect thing. Can you imagine how powerful and valuable being able to say something that would influence such a hostile environment? I mean, Jesus has got a hostile situation in his hand. This woman's life could very well be on the line. And he has the power to say the perfect thing. Wouldn't you think that kind of ability would be invaluable? Being able to have a skill like that you come up on two people who are absolutely about to tear into each other and you say, hey, hold on. And you manage to say the right thing that not only diffuses the situation but mends the situation as well. How much could you do for the kingdom of God with such a talent? I think you could do a lot. Finally,
They ask their question, and Jesus answers their insincere question. Their question was, "So what do you say? The law of Moses commands us to stone her. So what do you say?" It's a stunning example of influence and perhaps one of the most stunning in all of the Bible. Stooping on the ground, Jesus says, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." Can you imagine the looks of disbelief from these would-be assassins and supposed religious leaders? But reluctantly, they complied. But when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones, and Jesus was left alone with a woman standing before him. As we mentioned, this could be the most profound and dramatic example of influence in all of Scripture. Do you understand why Jesus' one line was so influential? Once we do, we will have at our disposal one of the most potent of persuasion practices, contrast. Contrast. I thought this joke was funny. We'll see. Contrast is not just that setting on your TV that changes the picture and the color for years and years. That's all I thought it was. It's like one of those settings on TV. It's not what it is. But contrast is actually when you compare two things. Again, it's easy to understand and it's easy to use. Easily defined, it's the difference between things, all right? And that difference greatly influences our perception and decisions. So a contrast is highlighting the differences in things. Okay? Everybody with me so far? Think about the term benchmark. Okay? You might use this term in a number of ways. I know it's used in the engineering field. It's definitely used in the educational field. It could be used in many more fields than even I'm aware of. I use it at school, and I also use it in fitness, and I'll explain how I use it. So if we have a new athlete that's coming in to learn how to do things, and you know maybe they're a little out of shape and they're wanting to get into better shape, we perform what's called a benchmark workout. We do this workout. We talk about the weight you use. We talk about how long it takes you to do the workout. And then in 3 months, what do you think we're going to do? We're going to do it again. And I bet you use a heavier weight, and I bet you it doesn't take you as long to do the workout. We're creating a point, a frame of reference to compare two things. Okay? I use it in school, you know, with the physical fitness test that the kids take. I use it when I'm teaching a kid to throw, you know, and I observe. I visually watch the kid. He steps with the same hand and the same foot. My benchmark is set. All right? Very simply put, this kid can't throw. And then I work with him. And then I work with him. And then I work with him. And then after a couple of weeks of our throwing lessons, he picks that ball up and he steps with that opposite foot and he throws. I measure the new move against the old benchmark and I highlight the difference. That's what contrast does. Okay? You probably see it and use it a lot more than you realize. It's a reference point. How we feel about something depends on the thing to which we are comparing it. Let's talk about some everyday examples. Okay? What about price tags? You know, a lot of these, my favorite store, and Patty probably hates it, but I love it. I know my mom doesn't like it, is Bargain Hunt. Who's been to Bargain Hunt? I could spend a fortune in Bargain Hunt because I don't know if I'm getting a real deal or not. I don't. I have no idea. But I'm like, compared to $49.99, I'm only spending $25. That's a deal. It's the same reason I almost buy a television every Black Friday. I'm like, I don't really need one. But it's 55 inches for $199. I got to need that, right? Because I'm comparing it to something else. There's an infomercial out there, and there I think these infomercials are great at highlighting compare and contrast. And you can take almost anyone. There's one for a can opener. And this can opener, we all need to own this can opener. But it's the most awesome can opener ever. But when they show the guy who's using the old can opener and he's cranking it, he's like, he's like grumpy and his face is all disheveled. And he's like, and then he gets the lid off. And for no apparent reason, he just starts spilling it all over himself. And he's like, oh, oh, oh. And you do this as a viewer. You look there and you sit there and you go, stupid can opener. And then what do? They flash it to the new can opener. And usually that old can opener, the video is black and white. You're back in the Leave It to Beaver days with your can opener. And the new guy, he's like, And he has no problems. He doesn't cut himself like the guy in the old video, like slices his hand like all the way down his armpit with the candle. So they're creating a contrast for you, and then you go, look how much happier that person with the new can opener is. I've got to have one. Infomercials will get me every time. I will buy it in a heartbeat. I don't care. That Flex Seal stuff is going to be useful somehow, some way, one day. But we see it, you know, you see somebody who's trying to lose weight, and in the before picture, literally, like, I think they asked them to pose like this. You know, they do their before and after, you know, and the before looks like this. And then the after, whether they've lost any weight or not, they're... I mean, I'm like, you guys know what I'm talking about. So they create this contrast. They're forcing you to recognize the differences between two things. That's what they're doing. They also, this was one I had never considered, in furniture and electronic stores. I had never thought about this. This is brilliant. They put the super expensive stuff at the very front of the store. So you walk in and you go, $2,500 for a TV? Who would pay $2,500? And we just kind of shake our heads and we keep on walking. And then we get to the back and we go, $800? I guess compared to $2,500, that's a pretty good deal. And we may not have even wanted to buy a stinking TV, but we start comparing, and it's a very clever marketing campaign, to be honest with you. But this concept is not simply about everyday stuff. All right, think about this one. This is another everyday one, but it makes very good sense. Think about diamonds. What are diamonds always sitting on? What color surface? Black. Why? Because it shows up real well, doesn't it? The visual contrast makes it look far more dazzling and impressive. Why do you think children love flashlights? They're in that dark room, and them little two AA batteries flip on, and it creates such a contrast that it's so enjoyable. Okay? What if we could create this contrast with people on a daily basis, but in a way that would influence their spiritual lives? It's valid in far more important situations. What about marriage? This was really interesting to me. I think it's a very profound example. What happens when we begin to contrast our spouse with what the internet or TV or even our neighbor has? Does our view of our spouse change? Probably, whether we mean for it to or not. We probably begin to look at our spouse in a different way, and probably not a good way. We begin to maybe think that he or she doesn't add up. They don't measure up compared to what's out there on TV or the internet or anywhere else. Might begin to think they're not as attractive. They're not as exciting. Maybe even feeling that you got ripped off. That's just the thought that the author, that's not, you can say that to your spouse if you want to. Mine's not in here, but I did not get ripped off. Yeah. All right, moving on. But if you think about that, can you think about how dangerous comparing your spouse could be? Is it going to make your marriage healthier? No. It's going to feed poison to your marriage. It's going to have the same kind of toxic effect that a poison would. But what if we used it in a different way? What if we used it to strengthen a relationship? You know, we think about how we feel when we almost lose someone, or if we genuinely consider that possibility. You know, I wish I could tell you how many friends that are my age that are married, that their spouse just died. They just, whether it was an ongoing situation, or it was a scary situation, or a car accident, or what. And I begin to think about, well, that could very easily be me. And all that underappreciating I do of my wife, I don't do that anymore. I start to think about how terrible it would be if I didn't have her. Start thinking about how sad I would be if I didn't have her. It makes us think what life would be like without that person, and it causes us to have a healthy contrast, and we start to appreciate our spouse more. We start to think about how much we have a new reference point. We have a new way of thinking about things that eclipses how much better things could be. As a result, appreciation floods into a relationship. And it'll be a long time before we take our spouse for granted again. This concept can effectively be used when considering different positions as well. You know, not only in, you know, you could take religion, you could take politics, you could take an argument, and you have an extreme on one side, an extreme on the other side. And when somebody provides a middle-of-the-road solution, it stands out because it has the strengths of the extremes and none of the negatives. You know, it may be a silly example, but I see it a lot with kids on the playground. I literally had a kid come up to me today. I want to play robots. You know, and said, I want to play zombies. And they're arguing and fighting about robots and zombies. And I'm like, okay, what if you played robots for 5 minutes and then you played zombies? And the kid, when they see that, when they see that alternative to an extreme situation, they go, yeah, we'll play yours first. And the solution solves itself by using a contrast. Just simple stuff like that. And we're going to see how Jesus used it here. Let's get back to Jesus and the adulterous woman with the whole 2 minutes that we have left. We'll probably pick up here next week because I won't be able to do this slide justice. So we'll pick up here next week as well, probably. One moment, they're comparing her to the law of Moses. The law of Moses says we ought to stone her. What do you say, Jesus? The next minute, they're comparing her behavior to their own. And this he did with one sentence. One sentence, Jesus did this. This wasn't the only time he used this technique. The paralytic that's brought to Jesus in Matthew chapter 9, we'll stop there. So if you want to read ahead, read about the paralytic man in Matthew chapter 9. Thank you, sir, for being such an attentive audience tonight.